is Josh at the Beast, and I'm talking to Daphne Abiathar. She's a lawyer, journalist, and senior associate at the Human Rights First's Law and Security Division. And we're going to talk about the Obama administration and its policies on indefinite detention. Thanks for taking the time to talk.
Sure.
So we had Brian Dooley on to talk about Bahrain before, so I guess our listeners know about Human Rights First. But what is the Law and Security Division?
Law and Security focuses on U.S. national security policy and whether it complies with human rights principles, so both U.S. and international law principles of human rights. So unlike the Human Rights Defenders Program, which Brian is a part of, our focus is really U.S. national security policy, and our focus has been a lot on indefinite detention, Guantanamo, Afghanistan, related things related to the U.S. war on terror, basically.
And just to get a little bit of background, how did you get involved with Human Rights First?
I came actually out of, I was reporting for a website called The Washington Independent, which doesn't exist anymore, but I was writing a lot about Guantanamo and a lot of these issues. I'm a lawyer and also got interested in all the legal memos that came out of the Bush administration, the torture memos, and all of the kind of things that were justified by the Bush lawyers in terms of the treatment of detainees, and was reporting a lot on that. And at one point decided I wanted to go back into doing legal advocacy and came to work for Human Rights First doing basically the same thing, but as an advocate.
Okay. And let's get to some of the more recent things you've written about. You've been writing about Section 1024 of the most recent National Defense Authorization Act. And what are some of the points at which that law departs from international law?
Well, the thing with Section 1024 of the Defense Authorization Act is that it was designed originally, I mean, it was a good idea. It was designed to give more rights to detainees who were being held for a long time by the United States. And I had been focusing a lot on the detention in Afghanistan, and we had about 3,200 detainees in Afghanistan. So none of them were getting trials. None of them were even charged with crimes, and they were just being detained indefinitely. And Section 1024 was an effort by Congress to give them the right to a hearing before a real judge, a military judge, and to give them a right to a lawyer, because none of them have a right to a lawyer. So that was the intention of it. But then what happened was, first of all, the U.S. agreed to transfer all of the detainees to Afghan control within the next 6 months, and that they agreed to that in March. So that kind of undermined the purpose of Section 1024. But the Defense Department went ahead and issued the regulations drafted regulations. They haven't formally been issued yet under that law, because they're thinking, well, the next time we want to indefinitely detain people, we want to have some regulations in place for how we're going to do it. So they're contemplating some future indefinite detention, because they know it doesn't apply, if anybody, it might apply to up to 50 non-Afghan nationals who are being held in Afghanistan, who are not being transferred, at least yet, to Afghan authority. But it's clear from my discussions with people in the Defense Department that they're thinking about future wars, or this war in some other place, and how the U.S. government wants to detain people indefinitely for years without trial in other wars. So that's the way that they're looking at Section 1024, and what they did in these recent regulations is basically say it doesn't apply to anyone for the first 3 years of their captivity. So there's still no right to a lawyer. There's no right to a hearing before an actual judge for the first 3 years. So that's really troubling. And it's also really troubling for those of us who thought that once we pulled out of Afghanistan, once U.S. troops had withdrawn, we were going to stop indefinitely detaining people. This suggests that might not be the case.
And it's just that within the first 18 months, they have to make some sort of declaration. Is that right?
Within the first 18 months, you have to decide whether this person falls within the parameters of the law And then they have to, then they have another 18 months to apply the law.
So let's say somebody is detained and there's, apparently there's no oversight, no judicial oversight, or like habeas corpus or anything like that for that person.
Right.
They're held for 3 years, and let's say they be optimistic and say that the administration doesn't find some reason to detain them further. What happens to that person at that point?
You mean after they've had a hearing? Or you mean before?
Well, what happens at the end of the 3 years if they can't find a legal justification under the laws that are being approved now?
Well, in theory, if there's no legal justification for detaining them, they have to be released. But what we've seen in practice is there are a lot of people who there is no legal justification for detaining them, and they're still being held. So you see that at Guantanamo Bay, and you see that among some of the non-Afghans in Afghanistan, because for whatever reason, the U.S. feels it can't transfer them back to their home country, either because the U.S. is afraid of some security concern, or because maybe the detainee has just expressed a fear of being mistreated when they're returned home. So what we actually have are a large number of people who have been cleared for release, where you have some board of either it was a judge in a habeas case, for example, in Guantanamo, or it was just a board of military officers in Afghanistan who have said this person does not need to be held or doesn't meet the criteria for a detainee, but they haven't been released. So even though in theory the law would say that they should be released, it doesn't necessarily mean they will be.
Okay. And some of these stipulations that you'd say if they were approved by the Supreme Court, it would violate international law. Is that right?
Well, what violates international law is the concept that you have indefinite detention without charge or trial or any sort of neutral judge evaluating the situation and any sort of right and no right to any to a defense lawyer. So when I was in Afghanistan last year, I was looking at the situation of U.S. of detainees being held by the U.S. government at that time. And they were getting these very rudimentary hearings where they would get a chance to make a statement, but they weren't allowed to see the evidence against them. They weren't allowed to have a lawyer. And the people who were evaluating their statement was a board of three U.S. military officers. So there wasn't any neutral. There's nothing neutral about it. And most of the evidence was classified, so the detainee couldn't see it, and he couldn't really defend against it. So the conclusion that I drew from that was that it was a violation of international law, because under international law, if you're going to detain people, they're entitled to certain basic minimum rights, which are the right to a hearing before a neutral arbiter. Some people would say the right to defense counsel, but at least some sort of assistance in defending oneself, and the right to see the evidence against you. So those are kind of very basic rights that international organizations, the International Red Cross, others have determined apply under basic international human rights law. And the United States government says that international human rights law doesn't apply to U.S. actions overseas. So they've essentially said that none of these international laws apply to the U.S. military's actions.
But doesn't that, isn't there the supremacy clause in the Constitution that says that international law is the equivalent to the Constitution itself?
Yes. I mean, normally an international treaty would apply, but the U.S. government, and the U.S. is really very unusual in this regard. Most European nations disagree with this. Most countries that we have good relations with believe that the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, which is what we call international human rights law, does apply to a government's actions outside of their own territory. It also applies if, you know, their military is doing something abroad. The U.S. interprets it in this really narrow way and says it does not apply. So it's really an outlier in that sense. But there isn't really anyone to enforce that.
That's bad.
Now,
the way that the media reported the NDAA, like late last year, was that Obama was using signing statements, but in a different way than what Bush did, how Bush did, because Obama was using the signing statement supposedly to say that he didn't agree with a lot of the policies that were being carried over from the previous administration and that he would try to limit them. But that's not entirely the whole truth, right? There's more to it.
Well, in certain areas, he tried to limit, for example, there were certain ways in which the NDAA tried to limit the executive power, for example, to its discretion in how to charge and try captured suspected terrorists. So the Obama administration wants to make sure that it can bring, that it has the choice of whether to bring somebody to a federal court, an Article III court set up under the U.S. Constitution, which is a civilian federal court, when they're suspected of terrorism, which is where most cases, most terrorism cases are tried in U.S. civilian courts, or that it has the option, if it wants, to take them to military commissions. Congress and the NDAA tried to get all of those cases into military commissions. So there were some compromises made, and Obama made clear in his statement that he would interpret it as still allowing him to bring cases to federal courts. The other thing that was a big sticking point was the ability to transfer detainees out of Guantanamo Bay. And Congress has made that impossible recently. And the Obama administration interpreted the law to allow transfers in some very limited circumstances. So we just saw actually two people transferred to El Salvador who had been cleared for release for a long time. It has been difficult to get them resettled somewhere else. So that's part of what the Obama administration did. With regards to Section 1024, though, and detainees in Afghanistan, he said that that the provision that granted the right to a lawyer and a neutral judge for a long-term detainee was too intrusive on executive power. And he didn't want the Defense Department, because the Defense Department did not want to do this. They did not want to have lawyers involved in their detention operations. So he was basically saying, I'm going to interpret it in a very limited way. And that's, in a sense, what the Defense Department did was by saying that it only applies to people after 3 years. It's not going to apply to anybody who's really in custody now. And it's not clear it'll apply to who, if anyone, it'll apply to in the future.
A lot of the problems that I see coming up with this is in terms not being defined very clearly, like unprivileged, enemy, belligerent. Is there a criterion that can be used to determine who is and isn't one of those, or is it just up to a judge to decide on their own?
Well, that's a big part of the problem, right, is that an unprivileged, enemy, belligerent just means that it's a member of a fighting force that is fighting the United States. And the U.S. Congress defined that as being a member of Al-Qaeda, the Taliban, or associated forces. And the Obama administration has defined it that way as well. So that's very vague, because it's not like members of Al-Qaeda wear uniforms, and whoever an associated force is has never been defined. And it changes, you know, the government will decide that one group is associated with Al-Qaeda or not at different times. And they've refused to actually say what groups they're talking about. So it leaves it very open. And originally the Congress passed an authorization for the use of military force, which allowed this military force to be used back in 2001 when right after September 11th attack. So that was what the intent was to get the people, to target those who were involved in September 11th attacks. Now the U.S. government is interpreting it much more broadly to include members of, say, AQAP, Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, which didn't even exist until 2009. So it's become, it's sort of a sense, it's kind of a mission creep. It's become this much more expanded authorization for military force. And that's why things like this Section 1024 suggest that they might be thinking about long-term indefinite detention of other people, of other unnamed groups that we don't even know about at some point in the future as part of this same war. And it's not clear you know, many of us think or hoped that with the withdrawal of troops from Afghanistan in 2014, that would really be the end of this war. And these provisions all suggest that no, the administration and Congress is in many ways trying to continue the war beyond that. And that's a real concern because that puts us in a state of perpetual war.
Why do you think it is that when Congress passes laws with this kind of vague language, do you think that's because they want to give more power to the executive branch, or do they think that the courts are going to be up to, you know, be the ones interpreting that? Are they anticipating, like, future lawsuits in cases where that happens in the courts?
Well, you know, it's not clear. I think it's more politics than it is about the courts. I think that in Congress, certainly there are some Congress members who feel like they want to look at as if they're really, really tough on terrorism. And so a lot of them have kind of stood up and said, we need to put all these terrorism cases in military commissions, for example, and makes them look like, oh, if we're saying the military should go after terrorism, that means you're really tough on terrorism. But in fact, if you look at the situation of military commissions, and these are courts that are held in Guantanamo Bay for certain specific cases, they tend to actually take much longer. The verdicts are really uncertain. They're subject to a lot of legal challenges. Most of them end up in plea bargains, and the sentences tend to be much shorter. So it's not really being tough on terrorism to put these cases in military commissions. But I think there's a political pressure on some people, or some people in Congress feel like forcing these cases into military commissions makes them look tough and also undermines the Obama administration, because when President Obama took office, he said he wanted to close Guantanamo Bay. So this is one way of making it impossible to do that if you keep forcing cases into military commissions.
Well, that would make sense for the Republicans, but then why would the Obama administration go along with this so much? It seems like they're just leaving the people who voted for them in the interest of rolling back, you know, the kind of powers that the Bush administration took. They're just, like, kind of leaving them to the side.
Yeah, I mean, I think that obviously at some point early on in this term, President Obama decided it wasn't really worth spending his political capital on the terrorism, the civil liberties and terrorism issues. So in terms of, for example, closing Guantanamo Bay, he could have done it much earlier in the administration. He could have transferred a lot more people out of Guantanamo, or he could have held a lot of trials instead of letting them get pushed into military commissions. But he waited, and then Congress put restrictions on it that made it impossible to transfer people to trial in the U.S. So they forced his hand, and now he says, well, it's Congress's fault, not mine. But he could have made a much bigger effort, and it clearly was not a priority. I think one of the strategies of this administration has been to try to look very tough on national security, and they've succeeded in that. I mean, they've, as you said, they've kept up a lot of these Bush administration policies, as well as expanding the drone war, for example. So they're pretty popular in national security, and I don't think that the administration wanted to jeopardize that by doing things like transferring people out of Guantanamo or insisting on civilian trials.
Yeah, it just seems to me that the people that are going to appreciate that in their way aren't going to vote for Obama anyway, and that those of us that are on the other side are just going to be, like, disenchanted by that.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah,
from, like, a crass political point of view, it just seems like a bad idea.
Right. I mean, I think certainly the Obama administration took the kind of the human rights and civil liberties community for granted in that sense, and sort of didn't follow through on a lot of the rhetoric from a lot of the promises made early on. I mean, he followed through on some. You know, I do believe that he ended the use of torture and what the Bush administration likes to call enhanced interrogation techniques. The conditions of confinement, for example, in Afghanistan have improved a lot. Those are improvements that were all starting to have been made under the Bush administration anyway, due to a lot of public pressure and some court pressure. So it just wasn't an issue. I think he just kind of took a lot of people who were already in his camp for granted.
Yeah. One last thing. A while ago, Attorney General Holder, he was trying to distinguish between due process and judicial process.
Mm.
And Stephen Colbert made a joke about how he was saying that due process is just a process that you do. And it seems like one of those things, like when Alberto Gonzalez was saying that the restriction on removing the writ of habeas corpus doesn't mean that you have it in the first place. In the sense mm-hmm. that, like, when I first heard it, I thought, you know, there's got to be something more to what he's saying than as it appears. Mm-hmm. Is that, am I just being naive and optimistic, or is it really just as sort of bad as it sounds?
Well, I mean, it's funny. The thing about due process is it's true that it's, in the abstract, due process doesn't mean anything, right? It really means whatever processes do in that particular situation. And so when you're talking about a federal court system, due process means certain things that have been defined in federal law. In the situation you're talking about, he was talking about the targeting of an American citizen in Yemen, right? This is the Al-Awlaki case. So, and he was basically saying that guy doesn't have any rights. You know, I mean, by saying due process just means whatever processes do, he's basically saying he doesn't have any rights. It is really just what I want to do. And he was, and that was pretty clear. I mean, it's not so much, the problem there, the problem with the targeted killing program is that, again, you have these international laws that are supposed to govern who governments can kill in other countries, whether it's their own citizens or foreign citizens. And it's still not clear how the Obama administration is interpreting those international laws, why it chooses to think that it can kill certain people and not others. Usually in this sort of a situation, that person has to present an imminent threat for you to be able to kill them, or they have to be actively participating in hostilities. And it's not clear with Al-Awlaki. I mean, Al-Awlaki may be an easier case than some, but with many of the people who have been killed in drone attacks, it's not clear that they're actively participating in hostilities against the United States, as opposed to just advocating hostility or supporting hostility or financing it, or, you know, it's very vague. And the U.S. government has never clarified how it interprets the relevant international laws. So to say due process is whatever processes do is really just a way of saying, yeah, I'll do what I want.
So, again, it comes down to, you know, the laws not being specific enough, I think, right?
It's not that the law isn't specific enough. It's that the government either it doesn't think it has to follow the law or doesn't explain how it's following the law. And of course, with the drone context, you know, most of the targeted killings are carried out by the CIA. So the U.S. government doesn't even acknowledge that it's happening, although it sort of does. You know, I think Holder never even mentioned Anwar al-Awlaki in that speech, even though everyone knew who he was talking about. So it's this sort of classified program that the government acknowledges exists, but doesn't really. And so they feel like, well, they don't have to give any details about who they're killing because it's all secret. But at the same time, we all know it's happening. And yet we still have no commitment from the U.S. government that it's actually following the law, the international laws of war or the international humanitarian laws or international human rights laws that exist in the world that are supposed to govern the way governments go out and kill people. You know, and maybe people trust this administration enough to be killing the right people, but I think that's a lot of trust to give to a government when we've seen that the U.S. government sometimes kills the wrong people. And it also means that you're sanctioning the ability for other governments to go out and do the same thing. So I just think it's a very dangerous thing for the U.S. government to have a secret targeted killing program where it doesn't explain who it's killing or why.
And what kind of steps would you recommend our listeners take to help out if they're concerned about, you know, the U.S. being a rogue state?
You know, call your congressmen, call your senators, tell them that you think this is important. I mean, we would love to see Congress hold a hearing on the drone war and actually flesh out some of what's really going on and force the administration to provide more information to the public about it. You know, same thing in terms of Guantanamo. If you think that we shouldn't still have a secret offshore prison where no one has access to it except for, you know, the U.S. military, and we're holding people, many of whom have been cleared for release and have been found not to pose any danger, please, like, tell local, your local representatives, your congressmen and senators, because they really do hold the key in a lot of these things. They really have a lot of power to allow the transfer of prisoners out of Guantanamo, to allow the prison to be closed, or to force administration to hold hearings and demonstrate that it's following international law.
Okay. Well, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you for your interest.